Attention, South Dakota residents. Everything is fine. Everything is beautiful. Go back to your homes. Go back to your jobs. Trust in the authority.
Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep.
Keeping you docile and distracted during times of uncertainty. This is the South Dakota Department of Propaganda Podcast.
South Dakota's top attorney, among other elected officials, is expressing deep concerns over the recent decision by a New York City jury to find former President Trump guilty of 34 felony charges.
Alongside the attorney, Gov Christie Nolan, U.S. Senators Mike Rounds and John Thune, and Congressman Dusty Johnson have all voiced criticism over this development. They particularly take an issue with the pursuit of criminal charges against Trump, who is considered the presumptive Republican nominee for the upcoming presidential race.
Even Marty Jackley, the only attorney among these politicians and a longtime prosecutor, questioned the handling of the case, calling it a failure of the Biden administration. He stated that the U.S. attorney and FEC's decisions to not prosecute it raises deep concerns and further divides the country.
Senator Rounds has echoed similar thoughts, raising concerns about how this verdict could impact unity in the country. He also speculated that this could boost Trump's chances of regaining the White House.
Thune and Noon took a stronger stance, though. Both had endorsed Trump for re-election and called the case politically motivated and partisan-natured.
Despite differing levels of support for Trump among these South Dakotan Republicans in the past, the legal prosecutions of Trump have solidified their support for him. His sentencing hearing is scheduled for June 11th, prior to the Republican National Convention.
South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem has been facing backlash from local tribes. Her recent announcement for a tribal public safety crisis summit, scheduled for June 24th, was met with resistance from the Oglala Sioux tribe, who declared they will not be attending.
The Oglala Sioux tribe's president, Frank Starr, comes out, stated that this summit was a divide-and-conquer tactic by Governor Noem. He claims this is a deflection from her false allegations that drug cartels are operating on Sioux reservations.
Starr comes out's accusations stem from a speech Governor Noem made in January, stating that drug cartels were using reservations to spread drugs throughout the Midwest, a claim for which she provided no evidence. To add insult to injury, she went on to suggest tribal leaders were benefiting from these cartels.
Starr comes out disputed these allegations, stating there are no drug cartels on his tribal lands, according to an assistant U.S. attorney. He further criticized the governor for meddling in the tribe's internal affairs and blaming the Biden administration for problems that have persisted for decades.
The Lower Brule Sioux tribe has also decided not to attend the summit due to comments Noem made earlier this year regarding Native American parents and their children's education. Other tribes are still undecided on whether to attend.
According to a study from the University of Essex, YouTubers might cheer people up more than casual friends.
These one-sided relationships, or parasocial relationships, are said to be emotionally fulfilling, even more so than interactions with weak-tie acquaintances like neighbors or coworkers.
Folks also feel liked, respected, and understood by fictional characters. It's interesting how these online celebrities and characters offer positive reinforcement despite the lack of personal interaction.
It's not just for the young or lonely. The study included over 1,080 participants across varying ages who reported strong connections with at least one online personality or fictional character.
While strong two-sided relationships, like close friendships or romantic partnerships, were still seen as the most effective for fulfilling emotional needs, these parasocial relationships can also play a significant role.
Precisely, particularly when people recall a time when a close other had hurt their feelings. Some were more confident that their parasocial ties could respond to their needs better.
piece discusses the financial contributions made to political action committees, or PACs, in South Dakota, focusing mainly on Toby Doden, a local businessman who contributed $100,000 to his own PAC, Dakota First Action.
However, there seems to have been a mix-up. Apparently, Doden intended for this large sum to be a loan, not a donation. The distinction matters because, under South Dakota state law, an individual giving more than $10,000 to a PAC could be charged with a misdemeanor.
Doden pinned this confusion on the state's outdated finance portal and stated that the necessary corrections are being made. His PAC has spent money on data acquisition and has supported right-wing candidates via text message campaigns, but has yet to make donations to individual campaigns.
On the other side of the aisle is the Triple R PAC. They take a more moderate stance and have financially supported several candidates. They've donated a total of $25,000 to their campaigns and paid for over $3,000 in other expenses, mostly advertising. Some of these expenses were funded by notable businesses and individuals.
The article also delves into specifics about contributions to individual campaigns. For example, Katie Washnock received significant support from Triple R and the leading South Dakota PAC. Chris Redder's campaign was also mentioned as routine, with no individual contributions exceeding $300.
Looking at District 23 Senate race, Steve Roseland's filing showed $8,200 in itemized individual contributions, with the largest donation coming from himself. He also loaned his campaign $5,000.
His opponent, Mark Lacka, showed impressive numbers too, with $25,350 in individual donations, and he secured funds from agriculture-related entities and in-state PACs as well.
In conclusion, it's clear that there's a lot of money circulating in South Dakota politics right now. However, it's essential that everyone involved sticks to the rules to ensure fairness and transparency in the system.
Drowning deep in my sea of loathing, broken your servant, I kneel. What's left of my human side is slowly changing in me. Will you give it to me? Looking at my own reflection, when suddenly it changes, violently it changes. There is no turning back now. You've woken up the demon in me. Sickness, open up your hate and let it flow into me. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Your mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Your father, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Madness is the gift that has been given.
Some companies are marketing themselves as woke-freed to appeal to conservative customers. For instance, right-wing media outlet The Daily Wire made over $22 million last year selling woke-free products like Jeremy's Razors, which was introduced as a counter to Harry's, which had pulled ads from The Daily Wire over political disagreements.
This isn't just limited to The Daily Wire. The shopping app Public Square markets products from businesses that align with traditional American values. And there's a website, buywokefree.com, that rates companies based on their wokeness and adherence to diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI.
It's interesting because, while some businesses are doing well with this strategy, others are finding that delving into politics can be a risky business move. For example, Public Square fell off the Apple App Store's free shopping apps chart, and some brands that were initially hit with backlash for their left-of-center politics are now seeing a resurgence in their reputation.
A recent Axios Harris poll showed that companies known for conservative leanings, like Fox and Hobby Lobby, saw gains with consumers over the past year. However, the same poll showed that brands like Sony, that aren't known for taking divisive stances, also have a strong reputation across the political spectrum.
It seems like more and more consumers might be getting tired of brands stepping into politics. Last year, only 41% of Americans thought businesses should take a stance on current events, compared to 48% in 2022. This might be an indication that customers want a good product regardless of a brand's politics.
I got that dog in me. Would you like that dog in you? I got that dog in me. Would you like that dog in you?
dip it in some mustard so you can go on and take a chew. As long as I got my dog in me, you'll always have a dog in you. I got you on top with a carton of tots, and all the ketchup packets are spent. Two all-beef patties to make you my daddy. The corn dog sticks got me bitching a tin. But before you go, there's one thing I must know. I got that dog in me. Would you like that dog in you? I got that dog in me. Would you like that dog in
me? Newsmax host Carl Habe had quite a tirade after former President Donald Trump was convicted on all 34 counts of falsifying business records to conceal hush money payments linked to extramarital affairs. Habe called upon congressional Republicans to go after those involved in Trump's prosecution.
He even insisted that they should interrupt their congressional duties to subpoena everyone involved in the trial, regardless of the consequences. He also urged Republican attorneys general to target Democrats, claiming they'll provoke an unwanted response by pushing those to support Trump too far.
Habe emphasized that those pushing the party that owns 90% of the guns are awakening a machine they don't want. He also made allegations suggesting Democrats want violence to cancel the upcoming election, which he believes they will lose.
He concluded by predicting a Republican landslide victory in November and a subsequent prosecution of Democrats by Trump. His heated comments have brought attention and controversy.
Federal program designed to keep rural hospitals operational throughout the U.S., focusing on a small hospital in Anamosa, Iowa. The program offers financial aid to rural hospitals, turning them into emergency health facilities and agreeing to keep their emergency departments open.
However, a surprising amount of these hospitals aren't embracing the program, with the CEO of the Anamosa Hospital saying it wasn't suitable for them, and nationwide, only 24 out of over 1,500 eligible hospitals have taken up the offer.
It's not because they aren't struggling. 10 rural hospitals have closed since this assistance became available. The issue here is a disconnect between this federal program and another called the 340B Federal Drug Discount Program.
That's a program that allows hospitals to buy drugs at discount rates and then bill insurance companies, Medicare or Medicaid, at market rates. The money made from the difference can be used to cover operational costs or to provide community benefits and charity care.
But here's the catch. Federal law currently doesn't allow these rural emergency hospitals to access the 340B discounts. This has prompted lawmakers to propose bills to rectify this oversight, including the Rural 340B Access Act.
It is evident that rural hospitals recognize the value in this program. Nearly 80% of rural hospitals have participated in 340B, with almost 40% reporting annual income of $750,000 or more from it. However, there is concern that some hospitals are exploiting the program and patients are not benefiting from its expansion.
Major pharmaceutical lobbyists are supporting the inclusion of rural emergency hospitals into the 340B program as they serve vulnerable populations in underserved communities. With drug costs under the 340B reaching $53.7 billion last year, authorities are scrutinizing its explosive growth and its impact on manufacturers' discount offerings.
It's clear that federal policy needs to find a way to help struggling rural hospitals without creating conditions for potential exploitation. There's no easy solution here, but as lawmakers propose legislative fixes, it's crucial to keep asking who benefits and how we can ensure these programs serve their intended purpose.
Bow down to this racist, overweight, old-faced clown.
Kristi Noem has hired her former chief of staff, Jordan Stoic, to lobby on her behalf and her offices. Stoic's firm, Stoic Consulting, which was recently created, will be paid $120,000 in 12 monthly installments, starting May 1st, 2021 through April 30th, 2025.
Stoic is no stranger to government work. He served as Noem's first chief of staff after she won her congressional seat in 2010. Then he moved to the U.S. Department of the Treasury in 2017 when Noem was preparing to run for governor. He later became Senior Vice President of Policy and Government Relations for the National Association of Manufacturers in 2018.
It's not unusual for South Dakota government agencies to employ federal lobbyists. In fact, South Dakota State University and other universities have done so, along with the State Department of Transportation. However, this move comes amid tense relations between Noem and the state's top Republicans due to some public disagreements.
Stoic's job will be to identify and monitor key federal issues for South Dakota, such as border security, tribal law enforcement, tourism, National Park Administration, the Farm Bill, national defense, especially regarding Ellsworth Air Force Base, and veteran services. He'll also advise on testimonies the governor might deliver to congressional committees.
So it seems that Noem's reestablishment of a state-paid federal lobbyist is focused on advocacy for South Dakota residents impacted by federal policies. This is a role that more than 30 states have also assigned to individuals or contracted out. In 27, geoscientist Terry Ingelder from Penn State predicted that there could be more than 50 trillion cubic feet of accessible natural gas deposits in Pennsylvania. This prediction was later revised to a whopping 489 trillion cubic feet, enough to supply the U.S. for 18 years.
This huge discovery led to a fracking boom in Pennsylvania, with about 13,000 unconventional wells being drilled. Now there's a new exciting calculation that's caught the industry's attention. Apparently, the wastewater from these wells could contain enough lithium to meet up to 40% of current domestic consumption.
That is indeed astounding, since lithium is a critical mineral used in many clean energy technologies, such as batteries for electric vehicles. It is estimated that around 1,160 metric tons of lithium per year could be extracted from this wastewater.
The Marcellus Shale Coalition, an industry trade group, reacted enthusiastically to this news, stating that it shows how abundant Pennsylvania natural gas can enhance America's energy, environmental, and national security.
Today, the U.S. relies on imports from Argentina, Chile, and China for its lithium needs. Given the growing demand for lithium as the clean energy transition accelerates, having more domestic sources is certainly a positive development.
The research lead, Justin Mackey, mentioned that their focus was on lithium as it's crucial for both American economy and defense industries and currently has insecure supply chains. He emphasized the importance of these materials in decarbonizing the U.S. automotive fleet.
Quite astonishingly, the researchers found that the highest concentrations of lithium in the Marcellus are comparable to lithium brine, water that is actually mined for lithium. Mackey believes this could be beneficial for the environment as well.
With news that a 37-year-old Rapid City man, William George Knight, has been indicted for 2 felonies and 5 misdemeanors for his alleged involvement in the Capitol insurrection on January 6, 2021.
The charges against him include obstructing law enforcement during a civil disorder and assaulting, resisting, or impeding certain officers. These are both felony crimes. Knight also has a handful of misdemeanor charges, all revolving around his alleged actions at the Capitol building.
Court documents reveal that Knight was part of the Stop the Steal protesters who pursued U.S. Park police officers. He aggressively approached a glass wall 4 times over 7 minutes, making gestures towards the police.
The narrative goes on to say that Knight breached the Capitol building, pulled in a makeshift bike rack barrier put up by the police, and was among those pushing a metal sign towards officers. He also allegedly shoved a Metropolitan Police Department officer and helped breach a police line at Lower West Plaza.
It's also worth noting that more than 1,400 people have been indicted for their roles in the January 6th incident. Knight's initial appearance was scheduled for last Wednesday at the federal courthouse in Rapid City.
The piece concludes by mentioning another indicted individual, Daryl Goins of Newell, who faces 6 felony offenses related to the same incident.
That's it for today.